Hi, everyone. Good evening. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. Tonight's broadcast is looking at the culture through the mental health lens. It's June 3rd, 2020. I don't think you can be here right now in this place in the world and not be affected by what's going on in our culture with the murder of George Floyd and the reaction to it. Both the protests, the rioting and the looting, with the reaction to the reaction, with the reaction to the reaction to the reaction. Even today, there were new things brought up in the charges against the police officers. I'm going to do my best to stay away from specific political issues, but I was asked by our diversity committee at Evoke Therapy Programs to start a discussion that's uncomfortable about race. And I didn't want to do it. I didn't think that I was the right person to do it. I've been watching people, various people on the news and in social media try to have a conversation about race. And I've seen so many pitfalls. I've seen so much anger and pain kind of flowing over onto everybody from all directions. And so I was really reluctant to do that. And as I was listening to the request of our diversity committee that I do one and others are going to do some also, I was really feeling sad and kind of powerless about not knowing what to do. And what my team shared with me is the thing that you can do is you can show up to the broadcast without being an expert. You can show up without getting it right. You can show up not knowing what to say and getting it wrong. So I want to say at the outset, I'm sure I'm going to make mistakes in it. I'm sure I'm going to say some things that are less than enlightened. And I'm sure I'm going to demonstrate my own blind spots in this discussion. But as the diversity committee suggested to me is I ought not to let that, and we ought not to let that prevent us from having uncomfortable conversations. One of the things that I've learned about having conversations about race at Evoke Therapy Programs over the last year is that we have to be willing to be uncomfortable. We have to be willing to make mistakes, to be corrected, to step in a direction at the risk of getting it wrong, and that we can learn as we go. So many parents, when we're coaching parents to show up for their children in this process, they will say to us, to our therapists and to me, they'll say, well, I don't want to say anything, not regarding race, just anything, because I'm afraid I'm going to get in trouble. I'm afraid I'm going to say it wrong. And I realize that we create a culture, even in the case of parenting therapy and parent education, where it's about getting it wrong or having your hand slapped, instead of saying there's an opportunity for learning and for growth. And so when I think about that idea that parents get frozen and feel paralyzed to say anything to their children with regard to just about anything, I realize that it's a similar kind of process here, that we step into something, we start having a conversation, and it's okay. I took a lot of tonight's information from the book Nurture Shock. It's a book that I've done a series of three broadcasts on in the past, and it talks about emerging research in child development and parenting. And when I went back to look at the book on my Kindle device, I looked at this one chapter that I remember reading about race and children. And I went to look at the highlights, and I clicked at the highlights that I had made, because I make highlights in the book when I read it. And there were no highlights on this chapter. And then I clicked on the popular highlights. And those are highlights that anybody who's read the book makes while they're reading it. There were no popular highlights that showed up on my Kindle device on this chapter. Then I went back to the slides, because I did Nurture Shock in three parts. I did chapter 1 through 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 is, I think, something like that. And this is chapter 3, I believe. So I looked at the slides that I made for chapters 1 through 3. And I didn't even touch on this chapter. Didn't say a word about it. And so I don't want to make too much meaning about that, but that means something. Back when I did this broadcast, I didn't think it was relevant, right? It was my privilege not to have this conversation. And apparently, parents reading the book, if my Kindle device is accurate, have made little to no highlights on this chapter. And so it speaks to the need, it speaks to what not just the United States, the citizens of the United States are making, both black and white citizens of the United States, but all across the globe. It's speaking to the need for a conversation, even if we don't get it right, even if it's uncomfortable. They start off in this chapter with a study, and they want to look at young children and parents. And this researcher came up with this study, and she separated the groups into three, I believe. One group was going to have a discussion about race. They were given prompts. Another group was going to watch a video that demonstrated sensitivity around racial issues. I think it was a Sesame Street video. And then there were those same prompts. And then a third group was just going to watch the video. The fascinating thing that happened is that several of the families, who, by the way, knew that the study that they were volunteering to participate in, opted out of the study right away when they saw the content. The book says five of the families in the last group abruptly quit the study. Two directly told the researcher, "We don't want to have these conversations with our child. We don't want to point out skin color." It starts with this idea that people, even liberally minded people, who have no conscious racism in them, no consciousness of any of their biases or racism, don't want to have the conversation and don't want to see color. So the chapter talks about the risk of making everybody colorless. Later in the study, the researcher realized how challenging it had been for all the families. A lot of parents came to me afterwards and admitted they just didn't know what to say to their kids, and they didn't want the wrong things coming out of the mouths of their kids. They wanted their children to grow up colorblind, but asked how many white people are mean, their children answered, almost none. Asked how many blacks are mean, many of them answered some or a lot. Even kids who attended diverse schools answered some of the questions this way. So these parents who believed, who communicated no overt racism to their children, who made an attempt to make race a non-issue, still had children in their families who had these biases, these prejudices with these simple tests. At first, she thought her dissertation was a waste of time. She thought she wasn't going to get a PhD and that she was going to at least have to start over with her research. And then, of course, one of her mentors pointed out to her that it might not be giving you, she thought that these conversations, that these videos were going to improve the child's awareness of race and diminish their racial biases. But it didn't have any effect. And so she thought, the mentor told her, but it's telling you something to be curious about. And so she changed her course. Most disturbingly, she said, she had asked all the kids a very blunt question. Do your parents like black people? If white parents never talked about race explicitly, did the kids know that their parents liked black people? Apparently not, she discovered. 14 said outright, no, my parents don't like black people. 38% answered, I don't know. In the supposed race-free vacuum being created by parents, kids were left to improvise their own conclusions, many of which would have been abhorrent to the parents. So all this is telling us is that not having a conversation, not expressing any overt racism with our children doesn't lead to the conclusion that we might imagine. Doesn't lead them, the idea that we can raise children who are colorblind as some ideal isn't important. That it's important to have difficult, uncomfortable, awkward, painful conversations around race. There's an incredible study where they randomly assigned children to wear red and blue t-shirts. There was no association. And the teachers did not talk about the red and blue t-shirts, ever, in their discussions. And I want to share you this outcome. It shows you something about child development. They liked the kids of their own group and believed they were smarter than the other color. The reds never showed hatred for blues, Bigler observed. It was more like blues are fine, but not as good as us. When reds were asked how many reds were nice, they'd answer, all of us. Asked how many blues were nice, they'd answer, some. Some of the blues were mean and some of the blues were dumb, but not the reds. Kids are developmentally prone to in-group favoritism. Isn't that fascinating. Without parental intervention and education and direction and conversation, kids were naturally, and this research suggests, they are developmentally predisposed to in-group favoritism. They're going to form these preferences on their own. Once a child identifies someone as most closely resembling himself or herself, the child likes that person the most. And the child extends the shares their shared appearances much further, believing that everything else he likes, those who look similar to him like as well. The spontaneous tendency to assume your group shares characteristics, such as niceness or smarts, is called essentialism. Kids never think groups are random. And so again, all this book is suggesting, all this chapter, I should say, is suggesting, is that we start having these discussions. And that's why we thought we would have. Your family might not be, and you, most of our clients, most of the families that come to Evoke aren't people of color. We have more than we did before because we've been practicing having this discussion. We have a therapist that's a Haitian American woman who's educating us, who's advertising to people that wilderness therapy can be very effective. She's advertising to groups and people of color. So we're getting more of that discussion. We're still way behind where we could be, but we thought we would have this discussion because even if it doesn't affect you, and I think what we're seeing in our society is that's part of our privilege, we can still have a different kind of conversation in our home that addresses unconscious bias, unconscious racism and racial issues, even as early as three. One of the questions I always get from parents is, how young can our children start to understand some of these complex topics? And some of the research in this chapter suggests that it can happen as early as three. When the kids turn three, cats show them photographs of other children and ask them to choose whom they'd like to have as friends. Of the white children, 86% pick children of their own race. When the kids were five and six, cats gave these children a small deck of cards with drawings of people on them. Cats told the children to sort cards into two piles in any way they wanted. Only 16% of the kids used gender to split the piles. Another 16% used a variety of other factors, but the age, like the age or the mood of the people depicted. But 68% of the kids used race to split the cards without any prompting. I think this challenges our notion about children, right? Early on, developmentally, according to the principle of essentialism, we start looking for in-group likeness, in-group preferences, and showing in-group preferences. It doesn't enter the level that we see in overt racism, but it starts to happen without a discussion. It's most important to talk, it's most important to not talk about race is the very developmental period when children's minds are forming their first conclusions about race. It's most important to talk about race at the time when children are developmentally forming their first conclusions about race. That was taken from a larger quote. It's most important during this time. Another idea that I think is prevalent in our community is the idea of the diverse environment theory. And they talk about this, where if you have children in an environment where there's a lot of diversity, that will naturally give them opportunities for friends and alliances with people of different color and different race. And so they're less likely to have racially insensitive, racial biases and racism. Merely sending your child to a diverse school is no guarantee they'll have better racial attitudes than children at homogeneous schools. The more diverse the school, the more kids self-segregate by race. The more diverse the school, the more kids self-regulate by race and ethnicity within the school. And thus, the likelihood that any two kids of different races have a friendship goes down. According to the University of North Carolina study by Moody, more diverse schools have overall more potential for interracial contact and hence more interracial dyads of potential friends, these researchers explain. But this opportunity was being squandered. The probability of interracial dyads being friends decreases in more diverse schools. Not something that we would intuitively believe. in less diverse schools, children were less likely to segregate and more likely to have a dyad, a friendship, an alliance with somebody of a different race. There's a fascinating study that they talk about, and I'm going to talk about some psychological take-homes today, but I love these studies to begin with. The Jackie Robinson study. They told two versions of the Jackie Robinson story. One was watered down and neutered, right? Took out all of the racial bias, all of the hatred, all of the taunting, all of the racism that he endured. And one told the story very, very overtly, very clearly, very honestly. White children who got the full story about the historical discrimination had significantly better attitudes towards blacks than those who got the neutered versions. Explicitness about it worked. We think if we water it down, we think if we tell a pleasant version of history, that there's going to be less racism. When in fact, when we tell the full story, it is more clear. There's a great study in here about Santa Claus. They in schools present a story where Santa Claus is black, where the story of Santa Claus is shown in storybook, and they show a black Santa Claus. The shock of the black Santa storybook did allow the children to start talking about race than had never occurred to them. And their questions started a year-long dialogue in these classrooms about race issues. By the end of the year, the teachers were regularly incorporating books that dealt directly with issues of racism into their reading. Both black and white children were collaborating on book projects on Martin Luther King Jr. And this is fascinating. When the kids read one book about the civil rights movement, both a black and a white child in this study, in this classroom, noticed that white people were nowhere to be found in the story. And troubled with this, they decided to find out about that. So by introducing topics that brought to the forefront the differences, the racial differences, you saw children having more compassion, more empathy, more curiosity, and a more connected sense to each other. So that's the research. That's what I wanted to share with you tonight. I didn't want to step too far out of my expertise, and that research, I think, shares gives us good fuel to say why I should have uncomfortable discussions. I wanted to share now some of my thoughts as a psychotherapist. What I've learned from working with other populations and how we can improve our understanding of what's going on in the racial divide in this country that's really just the generational legacy of hundreds of years of racial issues in this country, of racism. You know, when I've watched all sides of the discussion this week kind of lash out at each other, as I've delved into social media, into the conversation, I've spent a lot of time listening. And the thought came to me that that's one of our jobs, is to listen until it makes sense. I was talking to somebody today about this, and they were telling their perspective and their story about something. And at first blush, the story didn't line up with kind of how I saw things. It didn't match my perspective. And this was a white person, by the way. And then I kept listening, and I kept listening. And after a while, it made sense. That really is the goal of a psychotherapist. When parents say, why? Why did my child do this? Why are they doing this crazy thing? You listen until it makes sense. And like I talked about on the broadcast just the other day, when I was talking more specifically about psychology and child development and slightly related to the issue of race, I was saying, you listen to the story and you have empathy, and you can still have a boundary. You can still have a limit. That empathy or understanding is not synonymous with approval. And then furthermore, the fact of the matter is, no one's asking for approval. No one's asking for your approval. That's not the point of some of the things that are going on. Children aren't asking for your approval when they're acting out, when they're rebelling, when they're rebelling. Some of the people doing some of the things that they're doing today aren't wondering about your approval. They're not concerned with it. So we listen to empathize, to have compassion, to understand. That compassion and understanding informs us about our response. Like I said, pain and trauma is overflowing. I shared with our therapist before they went into the field this week. I said, we kind of called an unusual kind of emergency meeting early in the morning before they started their day, before they were heading into the field. And I was saying to them, your job as a therapist, as a psychotherapist, is to hold space for people's pain. And so make sure you're clear, because a lot of you are heading into the field with a lot of emotion around what you're seeing going on in the world, which is deserved and appropriate and makes sense. And what you're doing to make a difference in your lives and the lives of others, the lives of your community, is wonderful, and we support you in doing that. And the role of a psychotherapist is to hold space for somebody who's hurting. And that's why when I've listened to the conversation on social media about people getting angry to the reaction, and then people getting angry to the people that are getting angry to the reaction, I've just been listening. In fact, my partner, Rick Heiser, our executive director, who's not a therapist, kind of concluded this in-service that I was giving with this. He said, your job is to be a vessel. Yes, you can initiate a conversation and check in with people and ask them what's going on for them, but your job is to be a vessel and to hold them in their pain. So you've got to clear some of that out. You've got to find a way to make sure that you're taking care of yourself so that you can hold the pain for other people. Somebody asked me that this week. One of my therapists asked me. They said, are you finding a place to take care of whatever is in you so that you can be there for other people? And I talked about the place that I go, the therapy that I do, and having that safe place for myself. So the pain, the hurt, the trauma is boiling over onto everybody right now. And our job is to listen, to hear each other. Like I said, understanding doesn't have to mean approving, but also no one is asking for you to approve of their way of grieving. The idea of othering. Othering is a defense. I talk about this in the book, The Audacity to Be You. Othering is a defense that makes us feel good about us. It is a defense in a reaction to fear, a defense in a reaction to powerlessness, as we turn other into something else entirely, something different. And we justify it by the small differences. Othering is a way for us to keep safe distance between us and the truly disturbed, I say in the book. And othering is a psychological defense. It's related to the idea of objectifying. What I learned in working with violent offenders, I had a job before wilderness therapy, and I worked with men that were convicted of domestic violence, and I worked with sex offenders. What I learned about them in my work was, at some point in their life, from their various experiences of trauma and pain, they experienced their own objectification. They either were turned into and treated like an object, or they turned themselves into an object in order to tolerate, to numb, to escape the pain. So when you are turned into an object, or you become an object, a non-feeling thing, then you see others as non-feeling things. And so when you're hurting somebody, when you're enacting violence on somebody, you are disconnected from their humanity. I said to the therapist this week, I said, you know, our job is to make sure that our clients, our students, don't go out there and lose contact with the humanity of others. If you've seen the video of the officer kneeling on George Floyd until he died, you can sense that he lost contact with the humanity with his hands in his pocket. He had no sense of the human being that he was killing. And so this, the cure to objectifying people is not to tell people you're doing the wrong thing. You should feel guilty. Look at what your victim feels like. That's kind of the layperson's idea. That's what I thought, right? Look what you did to the children you molested, the women that you raped, the spouse or the girlfriend that you beat. Look at the bruises. Look at the pictures. And when these things are deep-seated, they have no connection. The pictures, they strike them as nothing. They're looking at things. So what's the cure for objectifying? How do you get a narcissist or a sociopath or just somebody who has lost their empathic ability? How do you get them to sense and see the humanity in others, to see and connect to other suffering? And the answer is, and it's not a short-term answer, it's not a quick fix, is you teach them how to feel. And so as counterintuitive as that might sound, when we were working with sex offenders, and we worked with them for a lot of years, in fact, I had the luxury of never having to graduate one of them from our program because it's a long-term treatment plan. You teach them how to feel. And when people learn how to feel, and some of those feeling muscles, feeling mechanisms are so far frozen, so far buried, that it takes a long time and sometimes it seems impossible, perhaps maybe impossible. You teach people how to feel and they recognize feelings in others. So peeling this back from race, your children, if you complain that your children don't have empathy, don't see how they're affecting others, the natural impulse for the layperson is to point out how they're affecting others, right? That was the old impact letter that we used to have parents write. But instead, you use therapy. You teach people to get in touch with their pain. And when they sense their own pain, they recognize it in others. If they can't feel their pain, if they have been reduced to objects, then they see other people as objects. And so I think what's being asked of all of us right now is to listen and to hear others' pain. I said this the other night, borrowing the quote from Martin Luther King, that a riot is the language of the unheard. And I shared a quote from Jamie Gill that said, with teenagers, with children, rebellion is kind of a last resort, an end of the line option. What the violence tells us is it tells us about their pain. And it's because they don't feel heard. And so that's why we spend so much time teaching you all how to listen, how to really deeply listen, so that the pain, the symptomology, the aggression, the anger, the violence, the rebellion has a place to be heard and doesn't have to escalate to that level. Lecturing, anger, protesting, and other ways of impacting things. You know, I said this today, I think the violence might work. I think that some of the violence that we're seeing might work. We might finally listen to it. I wish it didn't have to get to that point. I wish that wasn't true. From a behavioral standpoint, I'm aware of a desire not to want to reinforce violence. I mean, all those things are true. I just don't know if anything else will work up to this point, or has worked up to this point. It seems to be, the conversation seems to be more widespread and deeper and louder than it's ever been in my lifetime. And I wasn't here, I was born in 68, so I wasn't here for that. But every conscious moment since then, to me, doesn't seem so clearly communicated as what we're seeing right now. Like I said, take time. Everybody within the sound of my voice, black, white, has a right to their pain. And find a safe place to express it. You know, I think in some ways, people are using social media as therapy. And I don't want to be flippant about it, but suffice to say, social media is not a safe place to express your pain. Hopefully, ideally, your family is. Hopefully, ideally, therapy is. You know, you get to express your unique pain in therapy. And when you do, just like everything that I talk about, then you can be there for other people more. So find a safe place to be held, to have your pain held. And it's most likely not the internet. In staff meeting, when we had this emergency, or it wasn't an emergency, it was just a quickly called staff meeting to talk to all the staff and all the therapists that entered the field. And I said this on Monday night, like, this is our vehicle. You know, we're counselors. My goal is for all of our clients, parents and children alike, to get in touch with their humanity, with their pain, with their grief, with their history, so that they can connect to other people, listen to other people. I say in the Audacity to Be You, to understand another person, you have to lose your mind. It's a kind of just a fun way of saying you have to get outside of yourself. You're going to have to think different. Gandhi said, and I wrote about this in an entire chapter on this, to love other as other, you have to take on your own differentiation. You have to travel your own journey. And this ability to love other as other, he calls love. So I'm nowhere close to rooting out all of my racism. I'm nowhere close to knowing all the right things to say. But what the research that I shared with you tonight suggests, what we're hearing, what I'm understanding is that ought not to prevent us from trying to enter the conversation and to talk about it. And even if we think we're well-intended and we have this fantasy of colorblindness, we're not necessarily getting the outcomes that we want. If we live in a diverse city, it doesn't speak for itself. That human beings are naturally, genetically made up to gravitate toward in-group likeness and have a bias toward in-group likeness, people that look and sound like us. And so for us to progress beyond that, to grow beyond that simple wiring, that obviously is not serving us well at all in this country, across the world with regard to race or other issues of mental health and illness. That the only way that we can combat that is to begin to have a conversation, to talk about it. And we start with listening until it makes sense. And then we start to have courageous conversations, knowing that we're going to make mistakes. Knowing I don't know all the answers. I don't know how to do it right. This is me talking right now. I don't. But even as unpleasant as it was, I said to the diversity committee who asked me to do it, that's why I've got to do it. Because I can model being a self, being a person, getting it wrong, but still trying. So that was the idea for tonight. I don't know if there are any questions or comments, but I'm happy to take them if there are. One parent says, when my son was 3 or 4, we somehow began to discuss slavery, and I explained to him the horrible history of our country against blacks. He asked me, are we black? And I answered, no. Someone else says, this is the conversation we are having in our house right now. Can we share the conversation with our kids in Wilderness in our letters? Absolutely. You know, I just want to be clear about this because this came up in our clinical meeting that we called. Like, I think it's very appropriate to invite, I told all the therapists, you can invite this discussion. And if somebody's not ready to have it, as a therapist, you can take a step back. See, the goal in therapy is to facilitate healing and change. And I told them, don't walk in there confronting the defense, punching it right in the face. You can do that on your off shift. You can do that in one of the protests if you want to. That's your right. But psychotherapy doesn't punch the defense in the face. So inviting a conversation, sharing what's going on, absolutely you can bring it up. I told all the therapists, feel free to share. I was sharing an example with 9/11 where 9/11 at the time was absolutely traumatizing for me to watch. I had the day off and I watched TV for 12 hours that day. And I went to the field the next day with all kinds of newspapers. I wanted to have discussions about 9/11 with all of my students. And I was angry at the ones that didn't want to talk about it or who seemed to minimize it or not see how powerfully impactful it was to our culture, to our country. And I realize now my trauma was, I was asking them to hold my trauma. So with that example, I would tell you, invite the discussion. Ask about it. I said to the staff, you have some people of color in your groups. You have some people of color with your staff. You have some students that are overtly racist. Your job is to facilitate healing, to help them understand the mental illness involved in racism. And so we're going to use psychotherapy to do that. So invite the discussion, have the discussion, absolutely. And when you bump up against the defense, become curious about where's the wound, where's the pain, how is that symptom of an unwillingness, a fear to talk about it, where does that come from? Where does that originate? So absolutely. All right, I'm going to go on to upcoming events and then I'll come back to any questions before we close. Our intensives are now online, if you don't know that. So here's a list of our upcoming intensives. We're having our first in-person Finding You in June. It's scheduled the 24th. We also have one July 22nd through 26th. You can check our website or talk to our admissions team to find out, our enrollment team to find out more about what precautions we're taking to keep everybody safe. Finding You 2 is July 15th through 19th. We're also doing a Finding You 2 online, August 6th through 8th. That will fill up fast. Finding You online will be July 6th through 8th, August 12th through 14th, September 23rd through 25th. Just go to our website or email intensives@evoketherapy.com. Our parent support group's coming up tomorrow night. Trina is running our therapy support group for our wilderness families. If you have attended one of our intensives, the next support group will be July 14th at 6 p.m. Contact Malia@evoketherapy.com for more information or to get the Zoom link. We ask all current parents to go to 6 12-step support groups, any combination of Al-Anon, CODA, Families Anonymous, or AdultChildren.org, Alateen is for Teenagers, RefugeRecovery.org, or NAMI.org to find out other resources, free classes in your area. All of these broadcasts are available on your favorite podcast app by searching Finding You at Evoke Therapy Podcast or going to SoundCloud.com on your computer and searching for us there. On Twitter and Instagram, you can find us by using the handle @EvokeTherapy, or you can find the intensives program on Instagram by searching us using Evoke Therapy Intensives. Look for the Evoke Therapy Program's Facebook page. Also, the Evoke Family Foundation on Facebook, I mentioned at the beginning. You can go to evokefamilyfoundation.org or to the Facebook page or Malia@evoketherapy.com to find more information. They desperately need new members to continue to provide resources, fundraising. In fact, we're going to do it. I forgot about this. We're doing a fundraiser sometime when it feels like it's appropriate for us. We're going to make available the wilderness play to everybody. It was filmed. And we're going to ask for donations to On Guard Arts, who is a nonprofit theater company that does socially conscious theater in New York City. I was on the board at the time that the wilderness play was made. And 75% of the proceeds, 25% going to On Guard Arts, 75% of the proceeds will go toward Evoke Therapy, the Evoke Family Foundation, to go to help people that can't afford therapy. And then, of course, our Evoke Therapy blog. My two books, The Journey of the Heroic Parent and The Audacity to Be You, are available on Amazon. I'll let you know about the next topic. Our next broadcast will be Wednesday, June 10th at 7 p.m. Mountain Time. And I don't know the topic just yet. So somebody says this. If we say violence works today, is this the right answer or acceptance? I understand the statement as it is being getting attention and discussion, but is it the right way, the right attention? We talk about Martin Luther King and Gandhi. They were all peaceful protest or disruption. Today, though, there's violence. Is that right? Is the looting drawing the right attention or empathy that is needed? Yeah, I wasn't saying it was right or wrong. I wasn't making a value judgment about it. I don't have the stomach for violence myself right now, but I'm not on that end of things. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm not making that point. I'm saying I think it's working. I'm mostly asking for an understanding or an empathy, and so that will inform our ability to respond to people that are suffering. Do I think it's right when a kid walks into a parent's room and tells them to screw themselves? Not necessarily. That's not assertive communication, using verbal violence. I'm not making that point. I'm just saying, like Martin Luther King said, rioting is the voice of the unheard. Like Jamie Gill says in her book, rebellion is a last resort, an end of the line kind of strategy for people that can't feel heard. So the important point is this. The important point is that we learn to listen so that we become part of the solution. That's the important point. That's the point I'm making, is that we learn to listen better. And if we learn to listen better, we don't contribute to a dynamic where people think they have no other way to be heard. That's what I would say. That's my best answer. Somebody said, I got to see the play in Nashville live, and it was amazing, so moving. So I can't wait to share that with you, and we're going to put that together and make an announcement and send out invitations and ask people to make donations. There's not going to be a charge to see it. But we can't do that. It's not allowed to do that with this particular project, but we can ask for donations for people to see it. So we'll be asking for that. And we'll do it at the right time, a time that we feel like that it's topically appropriate to do that. And I think it's a fantastic play, real stories of real families. So absolutely. Any other questions or comments? Looks like those are all of them. I hope this was helpful tonight. Again, I'm sorry if I said anything that offended anybody. I just think it's important to have the discussion. I think it's important to listen to people that are suffering so that they don't feel like the only resort that they have is violence. So take care, folks. Be safe. Have a great evening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye. Shadows slowly chose.